listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As we reported earlier, there's been jockeying between the U.S. and China over Africa, or more specifically, over trade with Africa. The visit earlier this week by U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson to the African continent, including his meeting with the head of the African Union, provided a venue where Tillerson specifically addressed and challenged Africa's growing relations with China. Beijing responded at the National People's Congress, with Foreign Minister Wang Yi pointing out that China's relations with Africa do not involve the United States and need not create tensions between China and the U.S. Meanwhile, China has been moving across the world to up its game in its international relations, raising the profile of its global media. Dmitry Babich is a senior editor at the Russian news agency Sputnik, and he was again recently featured on China's global TV network, or CGTN, to discuss a number of international issues. We spoke with Dmitry Babich via Skype from Moscow on Friday. Dmitry, it's a pleasure to have you with us. And, gee, you're an international star yet again. I noticed you all over Chinese television recently.
Thank you. Well, Chinese are obviously making an effort to make their diplomacy more vocal. It didn't get much traction in the United States, but right. The Chinese have increased their expenses on the foreign ministry and on kind of explaining their foreign policy by more than 15%. So it's a pretty substantial amount of money for them. Obviously, they are trying to explain their position, but I'm not sure it's going to be really effective, because my impression is that the Chinese, much like the Russian leadership until recently, they view the West, I mean, they view the United States and the U.S. rational partners who just need to be explained that China is not dangerous, that China wants peaceful competition, that China is a lucrative trade partner. Well, the problem is that sensible people in the United States and in the EU understand it.
Right.
But the EU and the United States are not governed by pragmatic interests. Right. They're not governed by even by the presidents and the prime ministers. They're not governed by the voters. They're governed by an ideology now.
Yeah.
A rather crazy and radical ideology. Which, for example, prompted the former British Prime Minister David Cameron to cut all the aid, all the economic aid to African countries where single-sex marriage has not been legalized. Mm. And to me, that's like the pinnacle of stupidity, you know. Mm. You deny food aid to whole countries, to tens of millions of people, because these countries have not done something that the UK has been coming to for the last 400 or 500 years, you know, since the times of Shakespeare.
Also since the time, and actually, what was the UK doing 400 or 500 years ago in its relations with Africa? I mean, let's take a look at the newfound wealth that allows the West to be so magnanimous and so focused on esoteric rights, rests on the stolen labor and mass murder of people in Africa and the stolen land. And yet this is what they want to preach to Africans about human rights.
Well, I mean, it's just if you look at it from a pragmatic kind of healthy point of view, I mean, it's much more stupid than even Catholics and Protestants killing each other in the 16th century.
Right.
You know, maybe in future, when some extraterrestrials ask this question, why did people die of hunger in several African countries? Because a certain prime minister in Britain was so unhappy about them not legalizing same-sex marriage that he cut food aid to them. He basically didn't give them the food that he had and that they needed, and all of that because of these very strange ideas that he had about marriage. I mean, it's ideology, but it's an ideology in a way a lot crazier than even the religious fanaticism or than, you know, the leftist variants of communism. It's just absurd. But the point is that the EU and the United States now are governed by these ideologies.
You know,
it's very hard to believe that for the Russian elite and for the Chinese elite. That's why the Chinese elite is spending a lot of money basically trying to explain to the United States that we are not Russia. The message that the former Chinese foreign minister Yan Zhechi had for Trump when he visited a few weeks ago was, you know, China is not Russia. We're not going to challenge you in Syria. We're not going to challenge you in other parts of the globe. We just want to be nice to you, and we're offering you lucrative business deals. So, you know, you have no reason to be afraid of us.
That's right.
But the response from the United States was that basically if Trump could indeed formulate the U.S. foreign policy, the answer would be, the problem is not that you're not dangerous to us. The problem is that you exist. You exist, and you are not governed by the same ideology by which we are governed. We want you to be governed by that same ideology. We want you to be absurd. We want you to cut aid to Africa because they haven't legalized same-sex marriage there, or because we view their electoral processes as less developed than ours. Well, our electoral processes are actually pretty shit because people have a choice between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump in the end. But still, we consider it to be very important and ideal for the world. And for that reason, we are ready to waste tens of billions of dollars, if not hundreds of billions, on weapons. And we are ready to put the whole world in danger, and we will try to limit your influence in the sea that you rightly called South China Sea, but we don't care that it's South China Sea. For us, it's West American Sea. So basically, this kind of absurd attitude from the West is something that now an axiom, but the Chinese and the Russian diplomats are just very unwilling to believe in this axiom. In that sense, the Russians are kind of more pragmatic simply because they've got a lot more punches from the United States than China in the last few years.
You know, it's an interesting, first of all, trying to understand what comes out of the West from either Moscow or Beijing, I agree, must be almost impossible because it's so riddled with contradiction. You know, you have an elite here that has probably a better sense of its own self-interest than any elite in the history of humanity, just given by how much of humanity's resources it's been able to, you know, rape, pillage, steal, and loot. And acquire, and how much power it's sat upon for, you know, for a good part of the last decades, in any event. On the one hand, you have that. On the other hand, you have the situation like you described with the UK essentially purposelessly alienating chunks of the African population and of the African elites. And you have, at the same time, the game that's going on in Africa. We see with Tillerson, you know, being with the head of the African Union this past week, and Lavrov also, China, you know, almost on the outside looking in, according to Tillerson, while on the ground, China's making business deals here, there, and everywhere. There are all kinds of real competing interests between the hegemon would-be, or still, let's try to maintain hegemony, West in Africa with its history of exploitation of Africa and the rising multipolar world. All of that thwarted by this ideological, you know, hang-up that gets thrown, among other things. So I'm saying there's this ideological contradiction almost, and usually the ideology serves the elite. And in some places, though, it ends up being something that it slips and slides in.
Well, you're right. I mean, ideology is, when it is weak, it's used by the elite as a tool, you know, to further its own pragmatic interests. But the history of mankind knows a lot of examples when little by little ideology became the master. Instead of being the tool, it became the master, and these were the most, I would say, tragic pages in human history. I mean, it's clear that Adolf Hitler was kind of promoted and coddled by the German bourgeoisie, mm-hmm. because German bourgeoisie had some real fears of Soviet influence, right. Of you know, communist revolution in Germany and in other countries. That fear was, I would say, a lot more rational than the current hysteria around the so-called Russian involvement in the U.S. election.
Right.
Because people like Grigory Zinoviev or Vladimir Lenin or Leon Trotsky, they indeed wanted to influence Western countries. Right. However, the response of the German bourgeoisie was so absurd. You know, they basically made Hitler and his Nazi ideology, first they wanted to use them as a tool, and then in the end, they were Hitler's tools, you know, and they were tools in the hands of Nazi ideology. All of the German industry, all of the German war machine became slaves to this ideology. In the same way, ultra-liberal ideology now, which was primarily probably used as a tool by the American and the European wealthy classes in order to, win in the Cold War with the Soviet Union, you know, to offer attractive alternatives to the Cuban experiment and to the Chinese and Vietnamese experiments. In the end, now, this ideology is becoming the master of the West, pushing the West into all sorts of adventures. We have seen it already in Libya, in Syria, in Iraq, in a lot of other places. And this is the most dangerous point, you know, when the ideology starts to dictate some very dangerous, some very non-pragmatic steps. Let me give you an example. For example, Nixon in the early 70s, he had such difficult, let's call it, partners as Leonid Brezhnev in the Soviet Union and Mao in China. And Mao was a real Stalinist, figure. Yep. Very cruel, you know, a real believing communist, all kinds of difficulties for the United States. But Nixon managed to get Mao on his side of the barricade against pretty pragmatic and already not so belligerent Soviet Union. Now, Obama, more than 30 years later, 35 years later, having such sensible partners as Vladimir Putin in Russia and Xi Jinping in China, he managed to mess it up.
Right, it's true.
He managed to antagonize both China and Russia, despite their elites being very, very friendly towards the United States, having property in the United States, being willing to do business with the United States. He managed to basically antagonize them both. Why? Because Obama is a liberal kind of Stalinist, you know. He is a slave. He was a slave to ideology. He could not make concessions. Not even concessions. He could not be simply. He couldn't be sensible with Russia, and he couldn't be pragmatic with China. Let me just remind you. You know, he had this very bad conflict with Russia over Ukraine, something that Obama created himself by pushing the regime change in Kiev against all odds. And then after this conflict, Putin went to China. Russia could not sign a gas deal with China for 10 years before that. You know, the Chinese demanded too small a price.
Right.
And what did Obama do? He went to all of China's enemies. He went to the Philippines. He went to other ASEAN member states. And he reassured them all against China. So the result was that China signed that gas deal with Russia. Worth $400 billion.
Right.
And right. Obama managed to pull what I would call an anti-Nixon trick. You know, if what Nixon did was like a miracle of pragmatism, what Obama did was the opposite kind of miracle.
Right.
I mean, to get the most negative outcome out of the situation where you had the best cards on your hand.
That's right. I mean, declaration at the end of it, a declaration by the two governments of a security arrangement that they called a strategic partnership. We are now strategic partners, the opposite of what happened with Nixon.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, not only with China, but also with TPP. I mean, the whole thing with TPP was disastrous. Obama said it was an all-encompassing, you know, agreement on the future of the Pacific, and somehow he just forgot to include two elephants into this into this agreement: Russia and China.
Right.
Small emissions. The result was that now no one remembers what TPP is. You know, Trump garbaged it. But the negative impact on U.S. relations with Russia and China was huge, because China and Russia suddenly got some very reliable information. You know, they've got some proof that basically the United States wants to sideline them. And they almost did it by not including them in TPP.
Yeah.
So with Africa, again, you know, I think Obama should be, again, he should enter the Guinness Book of Records. He was potentially the most popular American president in Africa.
Right.
He managed to become the least popular American leader in Africa because he insulted his father's native Kenya.
Right.
By giving them lectures on democracy and not being willing to meet their president for some ideological reason. So under Obama, basically the United States and Europe, they were outplayed in Africa by China, right, of all states, you know.
Right. Well, Obama's legacy. Sorry.
A lot more money. China didn't have a lot more money, but China was just wiser and not so arrogant, forcing its ideology on the African states.
Right.
The communists don't force their ideology on Africa. The liberals do, alienating
right.
Africa. That's the most interesting, and I would say that's the irony of history itself.
That is. That's an interesting irony, as a matter of fact. China's policy, the communist state, the largest communist state in the history of the world, its ideology in terms of its international relations is win-win. You do what you do, we do what we do, we try to make each other make money. Ideology involved other than that.
Well, it's true, and basically with China, it's amazing how that country passed from radicalism, Maoist radicalism of 1960s, where it was one of the least predictable states in the world,
right,
to today's situation, when China is probably the most predictable and the most rational player at the world stage.
Yep.
The problem is that China is very rational, but it lives in the irrational world, maybe not yet quite grasping that. I think that the big mistake of the Chinese authorities is that they still hope that the United States and the EU are pragmatic countries, pragmatic entities. They still try to talk business to them, you know. Unfortunately, it's like talking business to Mao in 1963, you know.
Right,
you are talking to ideologized states, you know, which are ready to waste money, kill people, lie, simply because that suits their ideology. So if the Chinese want to understand whom they're dealing with right now in the United States and in the European Union, they should look at their own Chinese past and look at themselves in 1963. That would be the right kind of analogy.
Mm. Okay, so let's look at some of the things that have come out over the past weeks. The big thing, flip-flop, or in any event, the announcement that Trump and the North Korean government are going to be meeting, and Kim Jong-un and Trump are going to meet by May. That's quite a switch from, I've got a bigger button than you do, of only a couple of months ago. What do you think is happening here? Because to me, it looks like the conditions actually exist for this now for the first time in a long time in both Koreas and in the United States.
Well, I think both Russia and China should look at North Korea and learn, because Russia and China actually tried to accommodate the United States.
Yep.
Russia tried to accommodate the United States and the EU in sports. I mean, we made a mea culpa apology. We fired all of our sports officials whom the West didn't like. We tried to follow all the requirements. And the result was that we were driven from one humiliation to the other. So in the end, it looked like, Olympic Games in Nazi Germany, when it was illegal not only to produce the Russian flag, but it was even illegal for Russian athletes to boast of their medals publicly in Pyeongchang. China tried to accommodate the United States economically, and the result was, the threats of military force in South China Sea, the non-inclusion in TPP from Mr. Obama. So now let's look at Kim Jong-un. He didn't accommodate the United States. He called Donald Trump, quite appropriately, after Trump compared him to Rocket Man. Kim Jong-un made a much more, sensible comparison of Mr. Trump to an old idiot. And the result was that the United States accommodated North Korea. The North Korean team went to Pyeongchang with their flags, without any humiliations, not like Russians, even though I think everyone understands that WADA has a lot less clout in North Korea than in Russia. Let's put it mildly,
right?
The United States is most likely going to talk to North Korea seriously. This is something that North Korea has been requiring from the beginning, and the United States was unwilling to give. The United States is not yet ready to talk to Russia seriously, despite Russia being an old nuclear power and having a lot more resources than North Korea. But the United States will talk seriously to North Korea, right? So, in a way, everyone thought that Kim Jong-un was an idiot, but in reality, it's a very Christian story. You know, there is a saying that Christ has hidden the truth from the wise people, from all these Harvard professors, and revealed it to so-called idiots, like Kim Jong-un and some other tough guys from Asian countries, who simply refused to be intimidated and who refused to accommodate Mr. Trump and the American ultra-liberal ideology. The result is that Kim Jong-un is definitely much better off now than Colonel Gaddafi, than Saddam Hussein, than Slobodan Milosevic, and all those other people who believed Harvard professors.
Mm. You know, looking at, you know, you say the United States, for example, is unwilling, or Washington is unwilling to have a serious sit down with Russia, for example, and that it is suddenly willing to sit down with Pyongyang. But, you know, that implies that there's one voice or one, you know, body in Washington that motivates events. In fact, you know, there's this war between pretty much the entire government and the White House on the question of Russia that's been going on since the presidential campaign in 2016. Is it possible that the reason that we're seeing forward motion towards Pyongyang is that Trump isn't vulnerable on that? In other words, there's nobody investigating whether or not Kim Jong-un put Trump in office, as they're doing repeatedly with Putin.
Well, yes, but to a certain extent, I think Russia is itself to blame for this. The problem is that Russia has been trying to become a part of the Western world. We have been trying to organize our elections democratically according to the Western standards. We treated the Western press with respect, you know, answering their questions. And hoping that somehow in the end of the day they can be objective. Kim Jong-un didn't do anything like that, you know. He has elections that he likes. He doesn't contact the Western press, basically considering it what it is, a pile of garbage.
Right.
Basically operated by outside actors and having nothing to do with freedom of the press.
Right.
So, in a way, when Russia tried to play the Western game, the result was very negative because we, according to the Western standards, we are always in the very bottom of the table in all the ratings, all their estimates. And then we also get accusations of meddling in the elections simply because we basically try to speak the same language. We also try to promote women's rights and all of these quotas in Russia to the less extent than in the United States. But still, we are more or less playing that game.
You know, the big offense that this is what cracks me up. Following that same train of thought, the big offending act that they cited when they first started this Russiagate stuff was that RT had covered the third-party presidential candidates debate. In other words, the U.S. media has completely frozen out anyone but the Democrats and Republicans, and as a matter of fact, a private corporation conducts the debates between those two candidates. It's a private entity. And Russia, through RT, said, hey, all you presidential candidates, we'll put you on TV. Go ahead, go do your thing, and et cetera.
Yes, yes.
That was the most offensive thing that could be done to American democracy, according to the people in Congress like Barbara Shaheen.
You are absolutely right. And who is the worst Russian agent, who is Putin's most useful idiot? That is Jill Stein.
Right.
Jill Stein, the leader of the Green Party of the United States. You know why? Also because
she
participated in the debate, which was organized by RT at the last election.
Right.
Instead of discussing Mr. Obama versus Mitt Romney, right?
Right.
The previous election, the viewers of RT could watch Gary Johnson, and they could watch Mr. Anderson and Jill Stein.
That's right.
And their debate was a lot more interesting.
That's right. I mean, it was at least interesting. Whether it doesn't even have to relate to the others. This is a conversation with four American politicians discussing American policy.
And it was such a terrible meddling move by Russia into the stupidity of American elections. You know, the worst thing that you can do to the world of stupidity is to behave differently. That is really destroying the whole idea of American elections. You know, instead of two guys like Mitt Romney and Obama, I mean, two potential war criminals, trying to outdo each other in who of them will first call China a currency manipulator, who of them will first call Russia the most dangerous geopolitical foe. Mm. As a result, both of them did it. But it was so exciting to watch them. You know, they were like Siamese twins. And instead of that, you watch just some real debate between Jill Stein, Anderson, and Gary Johnson. Awful, awful. Real meddling.
That's terrible. All right. Dimitri, we appreciate your time. Thank you very much. And I hope to speak with you again very soon.
Thank you. Thank you, my friend.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The art of the deal is being put to the test. Can Trump, the former reality television host, broker a deal with the North Koreans? Will the deep state allow him? Also, is the world entering a new trade war? Crosstalking some real news, I'm joined by my guest, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Victor Olevich. He is a political analyst, as well as a leading expert at the Center for Actual Politics. And we have, of course, Dmitry Babich. He is a political analyst with Sputnik International. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let's start out. There was the phrase, Nixon went to China. Is Trump going to, at least metaphorically, go to Korea? What I find really remarkable, let me go to Victor first, is that I think he did this all on his own. He didn't tell anyone. And the reaction from his own administration, they were caught flat-footed. And, of course, the media is dead set against it because, well, they're a front for the deep state. What's going on here, Victor?
Of course, at least he didn't tell Tillerson, who said as much on his trip to...
Well, he took ill in Africa.
Yes, right after that.
Interesting.
Yes. It's actually good that he, you know, if he met with Lavrov in Ethiopia as they were planning, who knows who would have been accused of what. There, but with the trip to North Korea, first of all, it's questionable whether the trip will happen, considering all sorts of circumstances. Of course, for the real denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula to happen, the United States would have to do two things. First of all, it would have to give guarantees of non-aggression against North Korea,
which is what they've wanted all along.
Yes, but those guarantees would have to be—they wouldn't just be words, because everyone knows. knows how much words are worth, considering what the United States did to Iraq, to Libya, and to other countries that got rid of their weapons of mass destruction.
Syria.
So, yes. So what would North Korea want in exchange for denuclearization? It would want the United States to withdraw its troops and bases from South Korea, and, of course, a recognition of North Korea as an independent state. And on both counts, the United States is not willing to compromise.
And that's why I had it in my introduction. Will the deep state allow him, Mark?
Okay, I want to toss another alternative view in there. It is entirely possible that Trump went out on his own and the deep state is horrified. There is another possibility. South Korea and North Korea just had a very successful, you know, first blush spring of detente with this joint Olympic team, and they're talking to each other. They've agreed on a meeting in the DMZ between the two leaders. And Russia and China, Russia working with North Korea and China working with South Korea, seem to be playing some type of tag team to facilitate a process. And there's evidently some real substantial things are actually being discussed about security guarantees and so on.
Among the Koreans.
Now, we have mentioned on this show multiple times that we think that the U.S. needs to butt out of this process. The two Koreas need to keep the U.S. out of the room. This may be a chance for the U.S. deep state to interject itself back into a process that was bearing too much fruit
and
sabotage.
Didn't have enough American fingerprints all over it.
And sabotage it to make sure that there is no agreement between a South Korean president who seems all too eager for them on reaching some type of peaceful agreement with North Korea.
There's a lot of wiggle room here because it's saying the obvious that Trump is unconventional, but he basically was replying to an initiative through another intermediary. I mean, there was no letter, okay? We don't know the terms and conditions, and that allows actually Trump and the North Koreans and the South Koreans a little bit of wiggle room because they say, well, we didn't actually say that. But what I find very interesting is that Trump startled the deep state by saying this because there are no preconditions. There were always preconditions for talks, and then Trump has dispensed with it, which is really the real news here.
You're absolutely right. Well, it's amazing that the American press did not criticize Trump when he called Kim Jong-un a sick puppy, when he said that he is a rocket man on a suicide mission. That's perfectly all right. That's not warmongering, right? When he said that we have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea, that's fine.
They thought it was bad taste, not bad policy. Let's make the distinction.
And now they say it's bad policy. You know, when just a glimmer of hope for a dialogue has appeared, that's already a huge danger. Why is the United States press behaving like that? Because it is ideologized. For the ideology of neoliberalism, neoconservatism, which is basically one thing for me in terms of foreign policy, destruction of mankind is not a huge misfortune. Backing off, you know, making a compromise, that's a misfortune. How can we let this Kim Jong-un get off the hook? You know, that's the most terrible thing for them, not the destruction of the Korean
peninsula. What's really interesting here, and I think our viewers, the ones who watch this on a regular basis, is that it doesn't matter what president is in the White House, they don't want a peace on the Korean peninsula that doesn't have the permission of the deep state.
Meaning the complete collapse of North Korea.
Right. Well, I mean, the interesting thing is here is that, you know, there's talk of unification. There's always been talk of reunification, but under whose terms?
Right. The reason they don't want compromise is because they understand that compromise between North and South Korea would mean that the United States would no longer have a reason to keep its bases in South Korea. And the goal of the United States, of the deep state, of the American establishment, is to keep those troops and bases in South Korea. They're not there so much against North Korea, but against China. And
it's a huge footprint.
It's also close to Russia's Far East.
Right.
And so, as my colleagues have said here before, the deep state is very much against this trip by Trump, and they may still have a very good chance to have that trip canceled. It may not happen.
That's very interesting here. You know, Mark, the thing is, the dilemma that faces the deep state is that if there is an outcome in the hypothetical, an outcome in on the Korean Peninsula with the initiative on the side of the Koreans, that sends a message to the entire region. The Japanese are going to say, oh, so what conditions in which you withdraw from your troops from Japan? The Philippines, we're going to have Taiwan. See, it is a dilemma.
A domino effect.
Right, a domino effect. But, you know, the thing is that, you know, I always, when I used to teach European history, is that, you know, why did the First World War start? It started because of prestige. You do not want to lose prestige. Mm-hmm. The United States would lose a huge element of prestige in that very important country in that entire region. Yeah. And that's what keeps them up at night.
I think there's a degree. The U.S. is always concerned with prestige. They're insecure about their self-proclaimed leadership position over the world. But in pursuit of hegemony, they need to keep South Korea as their client state. They need to keep their military bases there. They've got ballistic missile defense, these THAAD systems in South Korea now. And the threat of an independent, united Korea. Historically, Korea has stronger ties with China and greater animosity with Japan. Right. However, right. small amount that is, right. that would be a break in the U.S. containment of China that they cannot allow. So they can't allow this to go forward. This is why I think the deep state is actually trying. They're behind all of this, trying to interject in the process. I think they know full what Trump was doing. Now, quietly, from what I understand, South Korea talking with China. China has been talking about Russia and China providing some security guarantees to North Korea. And South Korea has been making some promises that under theoretically, far down the road in the event of reunification, Korea wouldn't join any anti-Chinese NATO designs targeting. Well, and they've also promised to limit the number of THAAD systems, not allow any more to be erected in South Korea.
What's really interesting here is that, again, our viewers may not know this, is that under extreme security conditions in South Korea, an American four-star general is in charge of the entire military operation of South Korea. There are South Koreans that want their sovereignty back, to be able to make sovereign decisions for their own country and their own people. And, you know, it's the people to the north, they're related to them. They're the same yes. people here,
Absolutely.
All right?
Yes.
And again, this is going to be sending messages to other groups and politicians in Asia that are within this web of military bases that the United States has created in the Pacific. There are people in Japan will say, we should take care of ourselves. We're a rich country. And of course, it would be good for their arms industry.
Japan has been trying to kick U.S. forces out
exactly.
of Okinawa
for decades.
Not only Southeast Asia. I think that the United States are afraid that South Korea would go the way of Iraq. I mean, look at Iraq.
Yeah.
They let the Russian planes through to Syria without the Iraqi government taking the decision. I mean, we don't know exactly how it was taken. Probably it was Iranian influence, probably something else. But Iraq has shown a certain deal of sovereignty.
Yeah.
And the Iraqi foreign minister last week was in Russia and he was received at a very high level. Why? Because it's a sovereign country. They have shown it. So if South Korea goes the same road as it seemed to be going under President Kim Dae-jung, under his successor, Noh Moo-hyun, it looked like South Korea was becoming a sovereign country.
But, you know, Mark brings up a really good point here, Victor, is that if there is some kind of progress among the Koreans here, it could easily backfire against the Americans when they're saying, hey, we're a sovereign state and we can make sovereign decisions. This is where, you know, where you're going to hit a brick wall here.
Now, of course, the Koreans, both in the north and in the south, they do not want a war.
Of course
themselves.
They don't want a war.
They are, as was said here before, just like the Vietnamese, just like the Germans, they do not want to kill each other. They do not want hundreds of thousands of millions of casualties. And of course, the only side that would be okay with that to some degree would be the United States, because they do not really care.
So but can you spell Lindsey Graham? One of the most outrageous things to say. I mean, this is how empire thinks, okay? Mm-hmm. It has no scruples and it has no morality, okay? I got to jump in here, Mark. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Good stuff.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let's talk about spy mania that is overtaken, consumed the UK. Well, Dima, what does it all mean? Because from what I can tell, no evidence has been demonstrated to the public about motive, the means, anything that you'd have to do with a criminal investigation. They've really jumped their skis again.
That's exactly true, because they didn't produce a single shred of evidence that Russia is somehow involved. But, you know, last week I got 20 calls from the BBC, from Channel 4. They all wanted to kind of use me as, you know, the other side. And they just refused to do
that. What's the other side in their mind?
The problem is that the other side is supposed to be a liar and an idiot who just doesn't want to recognize the obvious. And the obvious is the most dreadful thing here. Just, I read the version from the Times. The version from the Times is that Putin is like Henry II, who got this guy Skripal delivered to him, like Thomas Becket was delivered to Henry II in 1170. They called me and they asked me what I thought about it. I said it was idiocy, and I didn't want to comment it. But, of course, they will say, oh, he's afraid
well,
to
was,
present
was he such an important person, Victor?
Look, Sergei Skripal was arrested in the early 2000s. He was charged with espionage. He was...
For the United Kingdom.
For the United Kingdom.
So he wasn't a Russian spy. He was a British spy.
Of course. He was a Russian military intelligence officer who defected who spied for Britain.
Who he was a double agent.
He was a double agent for years. When he was in Malta, then he was in Spain. When he was in Spain, he got into a honey trap, and then it went on, and he kept working for the British intelligence. He was arrested. He was in jail in Russian prison until 2010, when he was pardoned and exchanged for 10 Russian agents from the United
States.
Among
them was Anna Chapman, the famous one.
Anna Chapman, yes. So if Russia ever wanted to do something to Mr. Skripal, it would have done something to him when he was in Russian prison. To pardon him, let him go to Britain, live there for years, and then do this operation in which with a very strange way of neutralizing him, of incapacitating him, right before the World Cup, is a completely ridiculous scenario. One would have to ask a question: who benefits? Russia certainly benefits. It does not benefit in any single way from this. And the only ones who benefit are the Brits and the other European nations that are set against the World Cup in Russia and set for a further deterioration of relations between Moscow and the West.
Not all the Brits, but people like Boris Johnson. Let's be frank about it. Well, the normal
another
British people.
Nightmare
the British
another nightmare
the
personality. Mark, what's this thing, you know, with Litvinenko? We had poisonings, exotic nuclear poisoning, and now we have this nerve agent here. I mean, I don't understand this type of thing. If you're going to use this as a weapon, how do you know you're not going to be infected by it as well? It seems to me that there's, if you want to get rid of someone, you can make sure they go away in their sleep. I mean, this is why they do it. They need something high profile, really scary, spooky,
sensational headline,
outside hand.
As a U.S. military veteran, I stopped believing in U.S. weapons of mass destruction pretexts a long time ago. And this is what this is, just like Litvinenko, writ small. Litvinenko, polonium nuclear poisoning. This story is the same thing, except it's chemical weapon poisoning, right? Russia literally hit him with a chemical weapon. We don't have no evidence of that, but that's what you are supposed to believe. This, of course, the agent that was supposedly used, the nerve agent, if it's anything like sarin, unlike the slapstick operations with the white helmets in Syria, right, where they're running around without rubber gloves, touching each other, holding each other, carrying around, and no one's affected. We saw an emergency personnel in London who was affected by this nerve agent, who then immediately suffered the exact same consequences of going into a coma. And, you know, it's very unlikely that he will ever recover. But the press doesn't need any evidence that Russia's involved, right? We've just had the immediate assumption that, well, who else would done it if it wasn't Russia? Eli Lake, writing in Bloomberg, right? He's one of our favorites, right? He's a neocon, true blue, right? He whenever the CIA wants to put something out, him and Josh Rogan are the ones they go to. The title of his article in Bloomberg the other day was "Treat Russia Like the Terrorist It Is." Then the subtitle: whether the Skripal poisoning can be confidently pinned on Moscow is beside the point.
Is beside the point. Victor, go ahead.
Oh, footnote: for those that betrayed their country for the West, if you're of no use to your Western masters anymore, beware. They may very well have a final use for you, to use you or your death against the country you betrayed.
For one last time.
Yes.
Right. Okay, deep.
Well, I mean, it's not just Litvinenko, it's not just Politkovsky and Nemtsov in Moscow, who for some reason had to be killed near the Kremlin, you know, just showed that.
Somebody's got to choreograph it.
Remember, Georgi Gongadze in Ukraine, supposedly killed by President Kuchma's, people in 2001, as the Western press wanted us to believe. And then the new president, the pro-Western president Yushchenko, claimed that they found the head of Gongadze 5 years later, in a swamp, somewhere in Ukraine. Who can believe all of these stories? There are much more suspicious stories. Jürgen Möllermann, the former German Minister of Economics, who started criticizing Israel, for some reason committed a suicide not letting his parachute go, Then Andrzej Leper, the only real alternative politician in Poland, very anti-EU, very popular, commits a suicide right at the doorstep of an election he was going to win.
Jörg Haider
in Austria. Okay. And no one is suspecting anyone
of course,
in these
because it doesn't serve the
cases.
Political agenda of those that are driving this here. I want to ask all three of you before we talk about trade wars here. I think all of you have mentioned World Cup here. Is it going to work? I mean, the World Cup is the world, okay? And that's a pretty tall order. They want like a European boycott. The Americans won't be there.
The British establishment actually realized that the sports establishment in Britain is very much for participating in the World Cup. And the same goes for the other European teams, for the other European sports organizations. So they understood that in order for the sports organizations to be convinced not to go, in order to have a good chance of convincing them not to go, they would have to do something. There would have to be some extraordinary reason. Because what Boris Johnson thinks or says, the sports teams don't really care about that. Right. But they would have to be presented with something extraordinary to be convinced. And this is going to be presented as extraordinary reason.
Gentlemen, I want to switch gears because I mentioned in the introduction. Let's talk about trade wars here. Donald Trump has pushed forward his agenda on putting tariffs on imports here. The European Union has made it very clear that they will retaliate. We're still waiting for what the Chinese will do, what they'll do, and they will do something here. Mark, is this going to spiral out of control, or is it just, because we know that there will be exemptions, so Trump can say, I did what I said I would do during the campaign. I signed the executive order on tariffs, but then I talked it back a little bit, so it kind of equals out. So is it just a campaign promise, and it won't go too much further?
I think it has every potential to spin out of control, both as foreign countries take retaliatory measures, whether it's EU countries, China or others, Canada, Mexico, right? Because they're also big contributors of steel to the United States, but also domestically. Because as the prices of steel rise, all right, because of these tariffs, you will lose far more jobs as auto workers, as prices for U.S. consumers rise. This is the problem with neoliberal globalization, the architecture of the economic system, the whole world. Once you started it, everyone is interconnected, and if you try to back out of it and put these protective measures, then without a self-reliant economy, you leave yourself open. And Russia has gone through this same process very recently and has been busy finding alternative sources of supplies, decoupling, and import substitution building up its own industrial
strength. One of the things, Dima and Victor, the one lobby in the United States is actually terrified of a Chinese reaction, and that's the agricultural sector. Soybeans, huge export for the United States to China. The Chinese can make the agricultural sector in the U.S. sweat.
Well, I mean, it's becoming obvious that we're actually not going to have one globalization. We're going to have at least three globalizations. And that's because of the aggressive character of the U.S. and the European Union, who pushed their variant of globalization so aggressively. I mean, look at the whole idea of Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, doing a Pacific globalization without
China.
Russia and China. Isn't that a crazy idea? You know, the result is that now...
Not if your goal is containment.
Well, yes, exactly. The result is that now, across the world, you have countries that want to trade more with the United States and with the EU, you know, globalization number one. But you have countries that want to trade with China, and not only in Southeast Asia, but also in Africa,
you know,
in South America.
We're almost out of time here, Victor.
And you have the third globalization made up of ASEAN members.
Well, you know, I tend to think when I look at countries like China that export to the United States, well, if American consumers don't have any money to buy imports, then and that's just something the Chinese are beginning to realize, is that debt levels are so high in the United States, the ability to go purchase, you know, it's a non-starter. I mean, something like this should have been taken care of a long time ago. We said in the last edition of this program, this was built in as part of the post-war era, and now the chickens are coming home to haunt them. Go ahead.
Exactly.
20 seconds.
And that's why if Trump really wanted to start with bringing back production and bringing back American workers' jobs, he should have started with the infrastructure bill, which he promised, a $1 trillion bill
that both
chambers of the American
Because you gotta, you have to make something that people want. That
exactly.
is one of the elements of a great power.
Exactly.
All right, gentlemen, we've run out of time for this segment here. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.